Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of October 2019. Welcome to episode 53 of this podcast series. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this sort of pretty much the books I read during October. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter so you can find those. But those posts don't constitute spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, we do a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. Billy D., from the Magazines and Monsters blog and podcast, had a quick message. Enjoyed the show today, my good man. Before adding a spicy little comment about the Deja Thoris comic. That hot pirate queen from Mars can steal my booty anytime. Hypothetically speaking, of course, I'm married. Dream on, Billy. Dream on. Godzilla fanboy Luke Giaconetti had a few things to say on that episode, mostly about the Edgar Rice Burroughs rabbit hole that I fell into. Professor, I have fallen hard into the ERB-verse over the last few calendar years, being fueled by easy access to many of his books on Hoopla. I hear ya there, Luke. Besides Tarzan, I've really enjoyed the Pellucidar stories, which are my favorites, and the Casback cycle, consisting of The Land That Time Forgot and its two sequels. Casback is also the launch point for American Mythology's ERB-licensed comic book line featuring a modern-day descendant of Tyler Bowen. The result is slick, modern art mixed with old-fashioned pulp adventure. DC put out some really solid ERB books in the Bronze Age. Besides the Tarzan and Tarzan family books, the anthology title Weird Worlds featured an adaptation of the first two Pellucidar novels. If I remember correctly, this was the Mars feature that eventually moved over to the Tarzan family book. I'm always looking out for any ERB comics I can find, but they are seemingly scarce in my neck of the woods. Hoopla has a few volumes of Joe Kubert's Tarzan stuff, which is, in a word, beautiful. Coming out of San Diego Comic-Con this year, we got an announcement of a new series of licensed ERB Universe books, like books, not comics. Aside from the good news of new stories for Tarzan, John Carter, Pellucidar, Carson of Venus, and so forth, the announcement also presented that these are being written specifically to serve as a, ready, interconnected universe. In any event, I, for one, am excited for this development. Thanks for keeping me entertained on my commute and while working out, Luke. Thank you for those comments, buddy. I haven't read any of Burroughs' Pellucidar novels or stories, but a few comics have intersected with that, and I may dig into the original stories at some point as I enjoy Carter and Tarzan, those novels, a good amount. Or maybe I'll check out those new books that you mentioned. That last episode also received social media love from Old School Ross. Randy Watts drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, and also from the office down the hallway and around the corner from me on campus. Andy Leyland of Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. Slang Word Scott Mike from Comics in the Golden Age. Gene Hendricks from Two True Freaks. Karen from Between the Pages, the blog where pop culture and food meet. Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. Clinton from Coffee and Comics. Derek William Crabb of the Fanholes podcast, Chris Willett, and Vinny Gianfredi III. Thanks for those supports, everybody. And now, let's move on to the books I read last month. And as I do on this show, I categorize those comics. And first are issues that I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. And For Quarterman 144, I read Four Color Comics 1253, a.k.a. Spaceman number 1, from Dell Comics all the way back in 1962. And, of course, on the national holiday, October 9th, Doomsday. I picked up the book I talked about on that first episode of Doom Speak, Dr. Doom number 1. In comics, I read for listening to podcasts, and there are getting to be a good number of these because of the DC Universe app. And I love following along with comic book podcasts if I have the chance, and the app certainly gives me more opportunities to have that chance. So for listening along with JLI episode 29, hosted by the Remedial Shag on the Fire and Water Network, I read Justice League International Annual number 3. And for listening to our good friend Laurel and her squad on the Hunters podcast, I read a few issues that were actually pretty close to that JLI podcast area, in this case Justice League America 30 and 31, to follow along with their episode 20. And now that the first volume of Helena's first title has wrapped up, they are tracking her through various treks in the DC Comics universe. And to listen along with Mike Peacock's return to podcasting with new episodes of Justice's First Dawn, I read Justice League 84, which was not very good, and 86, which was sort of a PSA comic and about as good as those usually are. Again, that was on the DC Universe app. And then on to new comics that we read right off the shelves. Dial H for Hero, 7 and 8. As a maneuver in his battle with Captain Thunder, the Operator, a.k.a. Robbie Reed, sent out a message to all of Metropolis that whoever answered the call and dialed H would become a hero for an hour. And so we get Surprise, Phantasma, Guardian Angel, and of course, Futuristic Detective Flamingo. And one of those was actually a really smart dog. Then after that fluffy issue, we get in issue 8, The Origin of the Enemy, who is also Robbie Reed. Drama! And issue 8 is also laid out in an experimental way, page-wise, where the left-hand page counts, those represented pages 1 through 10. As you flip through, you just looked at the left side of the two-page spread. And that gave us the Operator's origin until we get to the splash page at the end of the book, which is pages 11 and 12, where the Operator and Captain Thunder both appear. And then the page count starts to go backwards. You flip backwards on the right hand of the page back to page 21. So there are two ways to read this, by page number, which I did, or by the way they just appear in the book, which is page 1, page 2. Page 21, page 3, page 20, page 4, page 19, page 5, etc. It's an interesting slash crazy idea for organizing an interesting slash crazy story. And once I figured it out, I sort of got it and appreciated it. But I am curious how the digital version of that issue appears in terms of how they order the pages. Justice League Dark 15, any comic with a badass detective chimp sword slung over a shoulder on the cover? Well, congratulations, DC Comics. You've got my money. We continue to gather magical good guys and bad guys, move people on and off the board, but as much as I like this, and I like the writer James Tynion IV, I would like for this to get into some action, some stuff happening soon would be nice. Legion of Superheroes Millennium number 2. At least in this issue, we do finally meet the Legion, although it is on the last page. But it's a pretty great last page, actually a two-page spread of this new version, this new take on the Legion. I dug Triplicate Girl's outfits, and M is in love with Dawnstar's look. And Rose Forest, Rose and Thorn will be joining as well, I assume. Me and M dig the Legion and are looking forward to the new series, but I don't think we'll be subscribing to the floppies. We will be trade waiters on this one. And I also read the first chunk of a new series featuring one of my all-time favorite characters, Lady Mechanica Sangre, 1-3, that is Sangre, as in blood, as in the vampiric-ish beings who are on the move in Spain. A woman whose teen son was subjected to a questionable exorcism by a questionable priest calls on Lady Mechanica to investigate to see if there was more going on than just simple demon possession. And in these first three issues, the series has five, by the way, Lady M runs into an antagonist from a prior storyline, La Dame de la Muerta, the Lady of Death. I like that in addition to giving us the traditional Victorian steampunk setting of England, Jo Benitez also gets us into stories from other lands, in this case Spain, and then we tie in Mexican legend as well. And I think it's a respectful, entertaining clash of cultures. And of course, I continue to love this cybernetic solver of supernatural mysteries. And on to the general comic reading that I did. In early October, Hurricane Shag blew into town. And he and I and Van Zee and little Russell Burbage met up for comic shopping and fine Ohio dining. And of course, we participated in the ritual of the exchanging of the comics. And the irredeemable one gave me a bunch of books that included the trade of Doctor Doom and the Masters of Evil. The trade was smaller than an average trade, a little bit bigger than Digest, but an odd size. Anyway, I had read the series before, and I really enjoyed it. But I saw that the collection also had a reprint of an issue that retells a version of the Doc's origin, Fantastic Four 278. It is hard to top Doom's origin as told by Jack and Stan in FF Annual number 2, but this one did hit most of the key bits. And from Dr. Anthony, the engineer, I read Punk's Not Dead, a very well thought of title from Black Crown from last year. In this one, we meet our young schoolboy hero Fergie, who suddenly finds that he can see the ghost of Sid Vicious. And that is when things get hinky. Interesting start to a series, and it has a lot of cool stuff in it. You know, you can see how a book like this, or this book in particular, could grow into a cult favorite kind of comic. He also sent Black Crown Quarterly number 1 from 2017, with previews from the aforementioned Punk's Not Dead and a range of other of the publisher's titles. Hard to tell from just a few pages, but a few of those, not all for sure, but a few at least looked interesting. And Dr. Anthony also sent a book from Vault Comics, Failsafe number 1. In this world of unrest, the true legacy of a rogue intelligence program is revealed. The U.S., it turns out, had some enhanced sleeper agents. And 10 years after, Agent John Ravaine thought he had killed the last of these, sleeper agents scattered throughout the country activate, and the world goes from bad to worse. We have Ravaine coming out of retirement for one last job. We get to know the president who's involved, and the president's niece is involved as his professional military advisor. So it is a nice mix of characters and a potentially really good story. And from longtime friend and supporter of the network, Luke Giaconetti from Two True Freaks, I got a nice care package recently. And I assume that is because Mrs. Giaconetti strongly encouraged her man to reduce his collection. I'm just guessing. But among the stuff he sent was War Machine number 6 from 1994. It's War Machine versus Death Toll, because 90s. And in a third world nation, we have Rhodey and his World Watch human rights group reveal terrible facts about a corrupt government. So good work there. Luke also sent a bunch of miscellaneous X-books because he wanted me to have the full 90s experience, including books from the middle of crossovers. So I read Cable 3, 4, 8, and 16, the latter of which was part of Phalanx Covenant Final Sanction. And I don't know what any of those words mean. Like many characters in the X-verse, Cable sounds interesting to me in theory. The time travel, the clone twin, the secret of who the parents are, there's a lot there to chew on. But like so much of the X-verse, it seems to get so convoluted so quickly. Not to say that there wasn't good in any of these issues. There was a lot of good. But I did feel like I was digging through the big hair in all the pouches to get to that good. And from Ron Sadowski, one of the first members of the hashtag comic book Circle of Life, before it was even called that, I read Daredevil 333 from all the way back in 1994. And boy, oh boy, was this a Marvel book from the 90s. D.D. had an armored costume that was mostly a bluish gray with just little bits of red, and I did not know what to make of that. And in this one, we've got problems going on with the homeless, and by the end of the issue, we see that behind it all is, of course, the Kingpin. And our good buddy Carlo Y sent in some comics recently, including The Second Life of Dr. Mirage, number 2 from Valiant, from 1993. This was fine in terms of traditional comic book analysis, but I want to mention that the first 5 pages or so was a werewolf attack. I thought about moving this to later in the episode when I'm talking about Halloween-themed books, but that just wasn't enough of a horror or monster take to qualify, but it was close. And because of that issue, I looked around Hoopla and saw that there was a new Valiant title that shares that name, if not much else, Dr. Mirage 1 and 2. In this version, Dr. Mirage is a paranormal expert and former TV star of a Talking to the Dead show. I say former because her powers have mysteriously failed her of late. The story starts when her new ally, Grace, tracks her down to tell the doc that she, Grace, can talk to the dead, and that she's been led to Dr. Mirage by the doctor's former co-star, who was also her late husband. It's a great setup, and the story quickly becomes rightly and correctly crazy and bizarre because of that premise. But it was an enjoyable read. The setup and the characters and mystery totally sucked me in, and I'll be checking Hoopla for when issue 3 comes out. A few months ago, I went over a bunch of the Punisher issues sent in by Derek William Crabb of the Fanholes podcast, and I missed one, because in a different spot in the stack, I found that he had sent the Punisher Annual, number 1, part of the Evolutionary War, and the intersection of the High Evolutionary and the Punisher, kind of a misfit, as you can probably imagine. It's actually a pretty good lead story with Frank in Central America taking out a drug kingpin. But not only does the story get more emotional and complicated than that premise might suggest, but he ends up going after some high evolutionary foot soldiers as well. Again, that part didn't really make sense, but it may have been the best they could do in working in the character into this big cosmic event. So there is that to be said for it. And from a recent care package from Sir I Was Joe, I read Maul, The Mad Haven, number 1 from Vault Comics. I was a little confused at first because there was a free comic book day a few years ago called The Maul, which was a crime story set in like the 80s or 90s in the heyday of malls. But this was a post-apocalyptic tale where the mall is the only safe place left in civilization. So an interesting take, interesting story. And I do not remember where I got this next one from, but I think vaguely it may have been a con. But I read Shazam, Power of Hope, by Paul Dini and Alex Ross. Very good story about hope and about the gift that hope can be to children, including a child named Billy Batson. And this, of course, is beautiful. I am a fan of Ross's comic work, and the nature of this one, how the text is laid out, the lack of speech balloons, makes it much more of an illustrated novel than a graphic novel or comic book. And in that setting, I think that really works for Ross and his style, because you're not relying on him for storytelling. You're relying on him to dramatize a little bit of the action from each page of dialogue, and that really works. There were some kids' books that I read this month, mostly from Sir Rob's care package, but a few also from Ron Sadowski. So overall, I read Archie's Pals and Gals Double Digest 38, Josie and the Pussycats 64, Jetsons 6 and 17, Richie Rich Best of the Year's Digest number 4, Yosemite Sam 8, 27 and 47, Jughead 286 and 310, and Playful Little Audrey 86. I don't remember reading any Jetsons comics before, but these were pretty good. And though it took a strange plot device, we were even able to have a Jetsons Flintstones crossover in one of those issues. And the Yosemite Sam stories weren't bad, especially the ones with my man Daffy Duck as guest star. And one of those, I think it was the Little Audrey book, had a hostess ad featuring Sad Sack, which was a delight to read. I'd never seen this one before, and when I ran it by Sad Sack superfan, the Irrelevant Shag, he had never seen it before either. So, mission accomplished. All right, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about the graphic novels, trade paperbacks, and long runs that I read in October.
Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr. If you're a history lover or a musical lover, you probably know about both Hamilton and Burr's rise to power in the early stages of American history and their infamous duel. But what if you didn't know the full story? What if one of them was a werewolf? White Rocket Entertainment proudly presents a 48-page full-color comic book, Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale. Written by Jared Albrecht, the yard sale artist, art by Nate Niles, colors by Ace Wheely and Ken Solomon, letters by Percival Constantine, and edited by Johanna Albrecht. Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale. Available digitally on Kindle and Comics Central, C-O-M-I-X Central. Prefer a print copy? Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale, along with my other published works, are available at theyardsaleartist.bigcartel.com. That's theyardsaleartist.bigcartel.com. Or you can buy it directly from me, creator Jared Albrecht, the yard sale artist, at any of my Comic-Con appearances. Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale. Get your copy today. You won't regret it. Don't take my word for it. Here's what Ming Chen from AMC's TV series Comic Book Men had to say about it.
I really enjoyed it. A lot of great werewolf scenes in here. A lot of great... This is how I wish history would be told to kids. Books like Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale.
That's Hamilton vs. Burr, A Werewolf Tale.
And we're back to talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read last month. And around this time of year, I like to do some seasonal reading. And around this time of year, specifically, that means Halloween-based horror-style comics. And first up, from the bunch of comics and then a while back by the generous Canadian Rob Lance. Most of these are falling apart, which is Rob's specialty. But from that pack, I got The Occult Files of Dr. Specter, number 20. This was a full-issue story, a novel-length adventure, featuring the Doc and his main squeeze, Lakota. They investigate an arriving mummy at a museum, and the next thing we know, the mummy is ready to marry Lakota on their way to the Egyptian afterlife. Fortunately, our hero is able to save the day, save the world, and save his main squeeze. And The Unexpected, 150, this one had three stories, but the best was the new one, the first one, No One Escapes, from Gallows Island. It's a prison story with no overt supernatural stuff, but a tragic and pretty sad ending of the Twilight Zone variety. And Secrets of Sinister House 9 and 16, not my favorite of the anthologies, truth be told. There were a couple of decent stories among these. The best one was probably the story of the Magic Dancing Shoes and their dark and terrible history. And there was one about the true history of the Yeti, and that wasn't bad either. And Ghost Rider, number 5 in this one. Ghost Rider goes up against Roulette, a gambler who is in trouble with a bunch of Vegas casinos, but in exchange for his soul, got the power to take them all out. But Ghost Rider said no to that plan. Silly villain, silly story, but it had a little bit of charm, I have to admit. And then other books that came from a combination of cheap bins at Pulp Reality or World's Greatest Comics. Some of these came from listeners like Billy D or Ron Sadowski. But I read Giant Size Werewolf from 1974. The star of this issue was the new story written by Doug Mensch called In a Very Self-Explanatory Way, The Frankenstein Monster Meets Werewolf by Night. And the story was, well, it was just that. But it was very, very good. A real treat of a team-up between two of Marvel's leading monsters. The rest of the issue is made up of decent enough reprints, but that lead story, that was really a blast to read. And Blade the Vampire Hunter, number 2 from the Midnight Suns line from 1994. This is so 90s, so cool, and so vampire-y. But it ends with a showdown of Blade versus Dracula, so at least you've got the dramatic ending for you. And speaking of the world's most famous vampire, Dracula, The Company of Monsters, from Boom from 2010. This is a 12-issue series written by Daryl Gregory from a story by Kurt Busiek. This is a different type of take on the legend, where a super-rich American businessman has found the bones of Vlad Dracul and figures if he can resurrect him, they can become business partners, which you have to admit makes a lot of good sense. And the man has dispatched his son to translate the appropriate texts so they can conjure the appropriate spells, and as these two issues end, they appear to have successfully brought the vampire back to life. Now, whether they can tame him, control him, use him, I suppose that's the story that the other 10 issues tell. And then from our other main monster, he was represented as well, Frankenstein 7 and 8. These actually represent a crossover of the big two monsters, because at the end of 7, a woman of magic uses Frankenstein to lead her to Dracula's tomb, where she raises the vampire. Hey, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. And then the monsters spend most of issue 8 fighting, because Drac wants to kill all the humans in and around Transylvania, and Frank wants to protect us. So good reads. Also read The Phantom Stranger 35 and 36 from the mid-1970s, with good lead stories being written by a very young Dave Michelinie, and they were good. But the best part of these issues was the two-part backup story starring Black Orchid. I really enjoyed that story of her taking on a murder-for-hire organization. A key aspect in that story was the development of rubber mask technology a la Mission Impossible, and that's always a good thing to see in a 70s property. In House of Mysteries, 253. This was from the Dollar Comic era. It's an 80-pager with 8 stories. And from what I could tell, they were all new stories, which did surprise me. I expect, you know, a new story or 2 or 3 maybe in an anthology like this, with the rest being reprints. But that was not the case here. Now, the best of these was a Western tale by Denny O'Neill, where a bad guy rides his horse into an ancient lost civilization, only to learn that he is not the being the natives are worshipping and want to cover in jewels and gold. It's the horse. And there was a demon child story with a nice twist, and a werewolf-style tale that wasn't bad either. And then back over to Marvel, I read Supernatural Tales number 2, an adaptation of H.G. Wells' Invisible Man. Ron Goulart wrote this, and he went on to become a very prolific co-writer and ghostwriter. Pardon the pun on ghostwriter there. And he definitely has some skill in the area of breaking down someone else's work. And it shows here, I think. I don't know all of the beats of the original H.G. Wells novel. What is kept in and what's left out in this adaptation, that I don't know. But as a whole novel, presented in just 21 pages of comic book pages, it works pretty well. And from Hoopla, I read Archie and Friends, 146 and 147, and I know what you're thinking. How does an Archie book fit into this Halloween segment? Well, how about if I tell you that this is a two-issue storyline called The Vampire Saga? It's a Twilight-themed story with a vampire and werewolf both showing up at Riverdale High. The question is, which team will the members of the Archie gang be on? And then even more of a stretch, I read JLA 10 and 11 from the 1960s, and it's not really a horror story, but it is a two-parter that features one of the leading supernatural bad guys, Felix Faust. He needs to find three artifacts to gain more power, a jar, a bell, and a wheel, and he has some demons on his side and uses his mystical powers to control the league members. It's an interesting story, again, not technically horror, but I thought it sort of, almost, fit into this category. So let's officially now move into the non-horror, non-Halloween reading. And the very kind Sir Iowa's Joe Crawford sent in some books recently, including Sarah and the Royal Stars 1 and 2 from Vault Comics from just earlier this year. Sarah is a hardworking princess trying to help her kingdom of Parsa in a time of famine. But her life goes another direction when she receives a vision from the deity Mitra, who tells her that she must find the Royal Stars and return them to the heavens. So she heads off in that direction, and things go from bad to worse at home, leaving her eventually without a home. And yet, she still has that quest to fulfill. So it's an interesting story, interesting world. I like the main characters, and I don't know that I've read a lot from Vault Comics. But this was solid, enjoyable. If the trade hits Hoopla in 6 months or so, whatever it would be, I'd consider checking in to see where the story goes. And from Ahoy, Joe sent Bronze Age Boogie 4 and 5, the penultimate and antepenultimate stories in this series. Consider that your bonus vocabulary lesson for the day. It's a cool sci-fi setup, a story that takes place simultaneously in 1975 AD and 1975 BC, because in 1975 AD, you remember, Martians overran New York City, which, considering the mayors of New York City back then, could actually have happened and nobody would have noticed. But it's all the machinations of the barbarian king Domnall, who is facing another invasion in his time. So he sends his daughter Britta to the future to nab the city's best street fighters to aid his battle. It's weird and wacky, and I really hope they ended up sticking the landing. And again, back from Vault Comics, Joe sent Queen of Bad Dreams, 1 through 3, which is scheduled to be a 5-issue mini. In this world, parts of dreams, figments, can escape into the real world, and there's a group of folk charged with tracking them down and usually reinserting them back into the dreamer's mind, or they can be sent permanently to the annex, or on very rare occasions, allowed to live. And when one of the agents, Inspector Judge Daher, lets one of her assigned figments escape, we learn that that figment escaped from the mind of an important politician's son, and so Daher's boss in the bureaucracy is not pleased with that choice. But learning more about this figment, maybe that's worth risking her career for? Maybe, maybe not. I tweeted out a picture of the cover of issue 1 because it is an homage to Mike Kaluta's gorgeous cover to Madame Xanadu number 1, and they do give Kaluta credit for that, and that was a nice touch. Now, I mentioned Shag's visit earlier in the episode, and among the books he gave me were a bunch from the All Ages series, Spider-Man Marvel Adventures. This is 1, 4, 5, and 7. I liked this one. It wasn't a straight kiddie book, but more of a late elementary or middle school age story, with some of the interpersonal school drama mixed in with the Stacys and Aunt May and Peter having a girlfriend. And we have a few cameos, and he takes on Bullseye in one issue. But that is all backdrop to the local mob boss, who is going after Peter. And the mob boss's grandson is dating Peter's good friend, Gwen Stacy. So it's a combination of good comic story, some hijinks, and heartache. And I believe this next one was one of the trades sent in by Dr. Anthony the Engineer, Guy Ritchie's Gamekeeper 1 through 5. This is from 2007 from Virgin Comics, and is the first of two trades for this title. This storyline is Tooth and Claw. We have a man named Brock, who works as a gamekeeper on a friend's estate in Scotland, keeping poachers away. But after a paramilitary squad attacks the estate to steal some secret papers, he has to tap into his dark and violent past in his quest for revenge. It's not a bad story, to be honest. Not terribly original. And certainly, as Guy Ritchie discusses in the intro, the story could be told as a movie. Now, it hasn't yet, but it does look like the options are still active, so I suppose there's a chance. And if they film it in the next few years, it's pretty much going to be Liam Neeson in the lead. Just saying. Dr. Anthony also sent from Archaea Comics Days Missing 1 through 5, which was from the Roddenberry line, actually, at Archaea. I really enjoyed this, both the overall storyline and the way it was delivered. The concept is that Earth has an overseer who has been looking out for us, and on a few significant dates in history, has folded time to erase a day from existence. And each of these issues tells the story of one of those days, be it modern or the age of exploration or some other era. And in terms of the delivery of the story, the first and last issues had the same creative team, but the three issues in the middle had a different writer and artist team, which worked because each issue is telling a different story and in a different era, with the first and last issues, you know, laying groundwork and then wrapping it all up. So the choice of having different, certainly different artists, but also different writers for those middle issues really worked in terms of telling very distinct, different stories. A really good setup. I had no idea what to expect from this, but it was quite enjoyable. It was very good. Last month, in talking about a ton of those Tarzan, Edgar Rice Burroughs books, I talked about the first 10 issues of a different character from the Burroughs oeuvre. And so I finished up the first omnibus of that, reading Warlord of Mars, Deja Thoris, 11 through 19. We had a story of Deja being possessed by a witch, almost bringing Mars under the control of an evil empire, but she resisted as a pure heroine should. There's a nice ongoing storyline happening here where Deja is morose, directionless, and even considers sailing off into the next world at one point. But that is the setup for the last bunch of these stories here. It's Deja off on a trek across the planet on her own, sort of a vision quest of sorts, which gives the opportunities for a couple of one-off stories, being the wandering heroine in a couple of situations. And I always like the mix of stories of different lengths in a comic series, so we get 3- and 4-parters, as well as, like I said, some one-and-dones. And a good, powerful, solid character, good trade. And by sheer coincidence, but excellent timing for reading in October, in addition to that witch story, there was also a vampire story as well, so that was perfect. And that was so good, I saw the second omnibus just sitting there on Hoopla. So I also read Warlord of Mars, Deja Thoris 20 through 37, which finishes off the title, start to finish. And we have to comment on the art, because it's crazy. It has to be said. Deja wears almost nothing, as do many of the fellas in this comic as well, to be fair. And a few artists draw her as they would draw Power Girl, if you know what I'm saying. But most don't go quite that far. And in the story itself, Since it is the way everybody is dressed, male and female, the amount of skin showing is rarely commented upon. It's an interesting take on that. But the stories in this second omnibus have Deja doing very good Deja things. Fighting, adventuring, occasionally getting kidnapped, breaking bones, breaking hearts. I like getting backstory on this character. And the stories themselves of Frankenstein-like mechanical men, of Thoris family drama, even of time travel, where Deja meets an ancestor, Deja Carter, from 1,000 years in the future. They were all entertaining and connected, like I said before. They were at least regularly referencing back to earlier stories in the series as the series went on. Hello, editor's notes. And what I liked about this is that, you know, in this version of the Deja Thoris story, she had a couple of 100 years of adventuring before John Carter showed up. So why not tell some of those stories? And from Hoopla, I picked up a series based on a TV show that I've just gotten caught up on, Wynonna Earp, Season 0, 1-5. This was created by Bo Smith, who our late buddy and wonderful podcaster, Sean Engel, used to call the manliest man in comics. And Smith co-wrote this comic series. The series takes place, I would say, after Season 1, but references events that took place before the show started at all, with Wynonna's outlaw past. We learn of the gang she ran with back in the days, the Banditos, made up of, you know, typical outlaws, mavericks, werewolves. The plot stuff was fine. It was standard supernatural battles. But what was good was the character moments, all those interactions, you know, all of those bits. And credit to the artist, the likenesses were very good as well. I haven't read any of the original Wynonna Earp comics that the show is based upon, so I don't know where this fits into that continuity, or if it's an attempt to meld comics and TV continuity, I'm not sure. But it was a fun read. And from the 50-cent box at Pulp Reality, I picked up an OGN, because if I can ever find a big book with lots of pages, square-bound especially, I give them serious consideration. In this case, it was Wolverine Doombringer. And I like the Japanese aspect of Wolverine, the samurai stuff, Mariko. And when you throw in time travel from the close of the previous millennium, 1,000 years ago, you have me in the palm of your hands. And this story has all of that. A time-lost warrior from Mariko's clan, Clan Yoshida, arrives to tell of the incomplete destruction of the world at the year 1000, and the forces that failed back then, well, they are gaining strength, and they're going to take another shot at that in the year 2000. And all that stands in the way is Wolverine and the Silver Samurai. Very nice story. I also picked up from Pulp Reality a few more issues from Hero Comics, Flare 1 and 2. I pick these up not because they're great, or that I love them. I'd say they're okay, and I mostly kind of like them. But I pick them up because they're extra size, 35 to 40 pages of story. And if I'm plopping down 2 quarters for a comic, outrageous! And I'm not getting necessarily the highest quality of comics entertainment. At least I seek out the highest quantity of comic entertainment. Don't judge me. And from Hoopla, I read some more of a character I read a bit of last month. This time it's Spider-Gwen Volume 1, 1 through 6, The Greater Power storyline. I like alternate worlds in general, and I like this one, Earth 65, in particular. Gwen has to clear up her name in the death of Peter Parker. She has to go up against her father, Captain Stacy, to do so, and also Officer Frank Castle. And when her dad learns of her secret identity, that doesn't help all that much. A visit to the pregnant Jessica Drew of Earth 616 was a good scene, but that didn't necessarily prepare Gwen to take on the new Green Goblins. even with the female African-American Captain America on her side. I enjoyed this. It's an interesting take on the spider concept, and I'll probably track down Volume 2 pretty soon. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, those Spider-Man Marvel Adventure stories were quite a bit of fun. That experimental issue, Dial H number 8, was cool. Dr. Doom has his own book, so of course that is huge news, and it was pretty good. I love Lady Mechanica. The Phantom Stranger and Dracula Company of Monsters books were really good, but in terms of what I thought was the best, I liked the premise of Days Missing a lot, and the middle issue of that series addressed the issue of consequences arising from the main character's power to fold time, and what, if any, crumbs would be left behind by that process. And could a really smart scientist notice that and deduce? And at that point, I was totally in, not just for that issue, but for the series. So that issue, Days Missing, number 3, was my favorite read of the month. Next month, in addition to Spider-Gwen, which I mentioned, I'm going to knock out some more seasonal reading. And in November, the month of Veterans Day, or Remembrance Day for our European friends, that will involve a lot of reading of war books. And, of course, a bunch of other stuff as well. And whatever I do end up reading, I will be here to talk about the books I read in November in an episode that ought to be out sometime in early December. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I've mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email to relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek, and of course the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening. And keep the pages turning.